So it's important for me to mention that this lecture is being broadcast as a live telecast to a listening audience of several thousand people in America and around the globe. It is part of the Teleclass Education Lecture Series for Infection Prevention and Control, which is a program started in 2001 and run entirely by volunteers. You can learn more about Teleclass Education at www.webertraining.com. And thank you to ASP for generously supporting this educational session through an unrestricted education grant. So this morning's session, The Infection Preventionist as a Leader, Refining Communication Skills, Building Relationships, and Breaking Down Silos. So we all know that effective communication skills greatly impact our success as we talk with others, as we approach our quality improvement strategies. And so it's very important that we try to break down those silos and enhance collaboration. It's with great honor that I get to introduce this morning's speakers. My name is Leela Looper. I'm from Mercy Hospital Ada. And this morning we'll get to hear from two great speakers on this topic. Kathy Adamson has been a nursing staff member at a large teaching institute since 1989. She has functioned in the role of quality and safety nurse champion, a clinical resource and support role in a busy adult intensive care unit since the creation of the program 3 years ago. She graduated from Humboldt State University in 1989 and has experience in the fields of trauma surgery, general surgery, outpatient clinics, and medical specialties intensive care. She is drawn to quality and safety because she enjoys supporting her fellow ICU staff in their desire and effort to do the right thing. Additionally, we will get to hear from Laura Showers. Laura has been a hospital and community nurse for more than 30 years and has worked in all areas of hospital nursing, as well as in maternal child home visiting. Laura's roles have included staff nurse, educator, clinical nurse specialist, and department director. Laura's professional philosophy is lifelong learning and personal growth. Laura has learned through the years that communication is a crucial element to the success as a professional. As a new infection preventionist, Laura has recent experience as a novice in this key role and has used communication skills developed over the years of working with people to effectively implement long-needed changes in her organization. Laura has been an infection preventionist since February 2013. Please help me welcome this morning's speakers.
Thank you so much, and thank you to APIC 2014. I've had a wonderful weekend, and I hope you all have too. My name is Kathy Adamson. I'm from UC Davis Medical Center. So I'm here to talk with you today of, and really just to tell a story of the Quality and Safety Nurse Champions at UC Davis. I am not an expert, but I'm learning, and I think we're all learning, so I thought we could all learn from each other a little bit today. I have no disclosures. I would really like to thank the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation for their generous support of UC Davis Medical Center and other Bay Area healthcare institutions. They've actually built us a nursing school right on campus, and they continue to support us in our HAI reduction efforts. These are our objectives. I'm not going to read them to you because I think you can read, but I do want to say that I'd like you, as Laura and I speak today, think of your own story as we tell our stories, and that possibly some of the things we speak with you today about you can apply in your professional life as well. A little bit about UC Davis Medical Center. We are a large academic institution. We serve a high-risk patient population. We do have a large burn unit, and we are a level 3 trauma referral center. You might guess that in a large institution, we have a lot of silos. So how many of you have at least 20 silos in your hospital? Right? I mean, they're everywhere. And what I'm finding in my profession is that as I get one silo annihilated, there's probably three behind it. So it is a little bit of job security, but it is an ongoing process that will be lifelong, I think. A little bit more about my area. We serve 33 counties. We have 619 licensed beds. We have 10 ICUs. And we serve 6 million residents. So we are, I said we were level 3 trauma. I'm sorry, we're the level 1 trauma center. So we get referrals from all over the state and part of Nevada. All right, this was my group the first year. In fall of 2010, we did receive this generous grant from the Moore Foundation, and 7 bedside nurses were charged with trying to bring our ventilator-associated pneumonia rates down as our primary mission. So all but one of us had already worked at the Med Center for many years, so we had a lot of relationships with fellow nurses and other departments, and we had no idea what we were doing. So we all got together, and we went to the research, and we looked at the 5 Million Lives campaign, and we learned as we went, and we received training from our infection prevention department, because we are not infection preventionists, we're nurse educators, and we work closely with infection prevention. So we started there with learning. There was a lot of tears the first year. How many of you guys have cried at your job? I have. Yes. So you can relate that there was a lot of angst the first year, and it got a little bit better after that. We did go through a lot of team building exercises, and we did go through Lean Six Sigma training and crucial conversations, and again had some IP training. So that's where we started. It's been 4 years since then. We did learn a lot about group dynamics. How do you work in a group? How do you get along with other people? How do you play in the sandbox? We've learned a lot about our own personality types and also the personality types of our bedside staff and of our administrative staff to really figure out how to make the greatest impact in our endeavors. We learned about learning styles. We did a tremendous amount of work with code of conduct, and I don't know if that resonates with any of you, but we learned how to not interrupt each other. We learned how to use body language correctly, and we did formulate a mission statement, which I've included up there on the slide for you. We have an opportunity to positively change culture by educating healthcare providers and reinforcing quality and safety initiatives at our institution with the goal of improving patient outcomes. So I think the real takeaway there is that we were working to improve patient outcomes as our main goal. All right, one thing we learned right away was that we weren't experts in everything, and I just took that away from Patty's lecture an hour ago, which is that you cannot be an expert at everything. So what you need to do when you plan any kind of quality improvement project is bring all the stakeholders to the table. For our group to get our VAP rates down, these were physicians, nurses, pharmacists, infection preventionists, and respiratory therapists. And I learned this later, but we did leave out our environmental services, which we have now warmly incorporated into our fold as a huge piece of the puzzle. But initially, we weren't aware of that. We all came to the table with the goal of reducing VAP. And I have to say, I had been there 21 years at that point. I've now been there 25 years. And it was my first experience with breaking down silos, because I was in a silo and I didn't even know I was in a silo, which was my own little universe. And I had no idea that there were multiple other universes out there that affected me and that I affected, and I didn't even know it. And when I learned about silos, I realized that that was something I wanted to spend much more time working on. So what is a silo? I didn't know what a silo was either a few years ago, so I thought I would just tell you. It's a healthcare subsystem in which departments function less collaboratively and more independently. So I'm over here in my tower, and I'm working on things, and you're over here in your tower, and you're working on things, and we didn't know that we're all working on the same thing. So maybe we're duplicating our efforts, or maybe we're canceling each other out. So it's really important for us to get out of our towers, for the patient, and then you will achieve optimal patient outcomes, which is what we're all striving for. So in our story, we went back to the basics and we re-educated to the IHI ventilator bundle. Excuse me. There's the bundle in orange. I'm not going to read it to you. But what we did realize right away is it's one thing to launch a bundle or re-educate to a bundle. Excuse me. But you really want to do it right, right? You want to document your good care and you want to be clear with your expectations. So it's one thing to document head of bed at 30 degrees, but is the bed at 30 degrees at every opportunity? So what we did was we stayed close to the bedside. We walked around. We helped everyone. And when you're helping someone, like let's say you're turning a patient, let's get that head of bed back up after the turn. Oh, I forgot. Thank you. So there's your just-in-time coaching moment, right? The head was down for the turn. They forgot to put it back up. And then you were right there at the bedside to remind them. More basics that we learned that first year, make it easy for your staff to do the right thing. I think if you leave with one thing today, it would be that. I would like to say to you, make it easy for your staff to do the right thing. What I've learned is that most staff want to do the right thing, but they need to know what the right thing is, and you need to make it easy for them to do it. Now, the Jumbo Walk is a Lean Six Sigma term, which is walk their walk, walk a mile in their shoes. They probably walk several miles during their day, and so walking alongside them is tremendously beneficial in figuring out what their workflow looks like. Listening to them is kind of an amazing experience because a lot of bedside nurses already have the answer, but they haven't presented it or no one's listening. So when I speak with bedside staff, and then I take that back to administration, and then we actually have a very high probability of making it work because the bedside grassroots staff figured out the solution. Staying close to the bedside is something I can't emphasize enough. My group, we all wear scrubs, and we jump in whenever we can. Not only are you helping your fellow nurse and therefore helping the patient, but they will then understand that you're there to help them. You're not there to audit them or write them up. So I would say keep your finger on the pulse of your units by staying close to the bedside, and that's what our group does. Just a little bit about clear expectations. This was some educational literature that we put out showing folks to keep the head of the bed up. I'm just using that as one example. We reestablished the current practice. Everyone knew the head of bed was supposed to be 30 degrees, but they really didn't know where the angle indicators were on all the beds. They didn't know how to train their eyes to see what 30 degrees looks like. It's actually a lot higher than you think. And then charting. Where do I chart it? How often do I have to chart it? So again, with a clear expectation, this was our what we call the data dictionary, which was another document that the champions wrote up, which was where do you chart head of bed? And if the head of bed is contraindicated to be 30 degrees, because we had a lot of spinal precaution patients, how did you chart that to get credit for your compliance? So a lot of education in that first year to the VAP bundle. Again, another slide just showing you education materials. We wrote reams of literature, and we tried to reach staff in a multitude of ways. I would have to emphasize that everyone learns differently. And so we had binders, we did huddles, we have an intranet that we would post regularly in. We have something called First Tuesday, where you can, on the first Tuesday of every month, put an article in your intranet. And we also just were extremely present at the bedside with one-on-one coaching sessions. And I would have to say, of all the things that we do, it's the one-on-one bedside coaching that's been the most effective in real time. Root cause analysis, just a word on that. I'm sure you all know what this is, but something I learned from Patty's lecture this morning is that involving your staff in the root cause analysis is probably the most important teaching tool you can give them when you do have a pneumonia or a CAUTI or a CLABSI. So what we try to do, and this is a picture of us, I like this picture because I don't know if you can see it, but there's a huge sticky note on the back wall. and I'm up there writing down what they're telling me, and then we have a lot of food on the table, so we always try to feed our staff and help them feel appreciated. So this was a little root cause analysis session that we had recently. Okay, so we implemented the VAP bundle. We started seeing our VAP rates go down. Awareness was high at our institution. And then 6 months later, we had a big spike in VAP. And that's, you can see with the red line, in June and July of 2011, we were headed downward. We had no VAP hospital, adult hospital-wide in May of 2011. June and July came, and it all kind of fell apart. So we went back to the table and held what's called a Kaizen, where you throw sticky notes up on the board again, and you figure out with a fishbone diagram all the factors that might be coming into play. And so we did this. And we brought all the stakeholders, the physicians, pharmacists, nursing, and respiratory therapy back to the table, and we started over. So what I want to tell you about this is that there's really no failure. What you need to do is go back to the table and do another rapid cycle of change. So that's what we did. And I would have to say at this point there were tears, but there was also a feeling of maybe this isn't going to work. Maybe we should quit. Maybe we should stop. And my manager, Jackie Stocking, said, no, we're not going to stop. We're going to figure this out. And so we kept going. We identified beyond the bundle, I don't know, there's probably a dozen things here, and I'm not going to read them all to you, but these are the things we saw come out in themes from that Kaizen, and this directed some of our work for the next 3 years, and we are continuing this work now, and we call this Bundle Plus. So this is beyond the VAP bundle, what our institution identified as needing to happen next. I'll just pick out a couple. We did bring in an outside consultant, and she followed us around for 3 days, and she wrote up 20 pages of things that we needed to do. And again, it took probably the next 3 years to implement a lot of these suggestions, but these are some of the things we're doing. I can't say enough about early mobility. Do you guys all have early mobility in your ICUs? Not so much. Okay, well, we found that getting patients up and moving as fast as we could really led to a shorter length of stay and much less delirium. So we got another grant and worked on that. We're also revisiting the sedation interruption process and early extubation. We're working very, very hard on getting our devices out. I'm sure you're all doing that too, your Foleys, your central lines, and your ET tubes. So we're working really hard on getting our device day rates down. Okay, you've probably seen this, rapid cycles of change. This was a drawing done by our performance excellence director, and I look at this probably several times a week and apply it to what we're doing. We try to figure out the current state and what the problem is, and then we go around clockwise. We do a root cause analysis. We try an intervention. If it works, then we implement it more house-wide, and if it doesn't, we go back around and around. So I'm sure this is what you guys are doing too, but what I've learned from this, truly, I was afraid of failure before this job, and now I realize that there really isn't failure. You just need to go back and try again. So that's what I learned. this was the original breaking down silos concept. One of my fellow champions drew this up to try and explain to people what we do all day. And I love this because you've got this patient in the middle, and all these departments are coming at this patient. They're like in the middle of this storm, right? They've got dietary coming in to see them. They've got the social worker, physical therapist. The champion nurse tries to tie all that together and bring us all together and keep the patient in the center. So this diagram really resonated with me, and I wanted to give it some more thought. So what we did was we came up with a very complicated diagram, but I do love this diagram because, again, the patient is in the middle. The patient is always going to be in the middle. And then the first ring is all the things we're working on. So we've got our early mobility, and we've got isolation education, and all the things that I know you're working on, too. And then on the outside, the blue ring, are all the departments who are working on these things, and we're working on them together because the patient's in the middle. So to me, this is a very meaningful summary of what we're trying to do for our patients. This is our group about partway through. We expanded to the Children's Hospital. We also got an analyst, so we were very excited to be able to compile some of the data, and also we implemented a quarterly dashboard that's online so that everyone can see how everyone is doing in our hospital. We believe in transparency, so we do post our results for everybody, to everybody. So that's my group. As I said, I'm not an expert, and I'm still learning, and we all are. So these are some of the things that we've been working on and some of the things I've learned. I've already said this, bringing all stakeholders to the table is crucial. Why? Because you need their buy-in, you need their support, and you need their expertise. So if you don't bring in, let's say, respiratory therapy, they're not going to really accept your program because maybe you missed something, and also because they didn't have a hand in planning it. So that's a perfect way to break down a silo, is to get everyone to the table. And be sure that you communicate all your work to administration, because you need their support too. One thing I've really learned when running these tiger teams, we call them tiger teams, is to walk out of the planning meetings with an agreement of who does what by when. So you don't have to do everything as the IP or whatever your role is, but we do need to figure out who's going to do what by when, or you're going to get stalemated. So we did learn that. I do want to say a couple of words about pushback. How many people have had pushback? Right? We all have. It kind of throws you off sometimes. But I do want to say that there is a difference between pushback and feedback. So sometimes people are actually trying to tell you where they're at, and it comes out in a rebellious or angry way. But what they're really trying to say is, this is where I am, and this is where you are, and we're kind of far away right now, so let's talk some more about it. So I try to take pushback, what I interpret as pushback, and really turn it into feedback. So that's worked for us. You must make it safe for staff to come to you, and Laura's going to talk more about keeping conversations safe, but it is crucial that staff feel safe when they come to you. So we do a lot of work with, no, I'm not going to write you up. This isn't just an audit. We're trying to tell a story with our bar graphs. You also need to understand silent resistors and violent resistors. So if someone is saying, yes, I understand what you're saying, and then they walk away and don't do it, those are actually the more dangerous of your population, because you don't really know who they are. And so I would rather actually have a violent resistor than a silent resistor. Finding common ground. Sometimes when you're in a escalating situation with a staff member, if you both can agree that you are doing this for the patient, it kind of brings the whole thing back down and into focus. All right, lessons learned. Again, not going to read all of this to you, but I do want to say, if you bring candy to your meetings or to your teaching sessions, people really like that, and it is just kind of a way of showing that you do appreciate them and you care about them. And I'm going to speed this up just a little bit. More lessons learned. Learn people's names. Learn your housekeeper's name. How many of you guys know your housekeeper's names? Thank you. That is fabulous to see, because I didn't like 4 years ago, and now I do too. And it means a lot when you say hello to people in the hall, or good morning, or hello, and you know their name. That goes a long way. And accepting people as they are, where they are, and accepting yourself where you are, that's taken years for me to figure out, and I'm still working on it. But nurses know when you are accepting of them. They can tell. And then they're more likely to come to you with their feedback. All right. Make it easy to do the right thing. Again, probably one of my main points for you today. This is a picture of our pneumatic tube system. We all want people to foam their hands before they open up the tube and take out the medication. Do you guys all have pneumatic tube systems? Right. So you want clean hands to pull the medications out that have just been delivered from pharmacy. Put the foam dispenser right next to it. When you're sending a blood specimen to the lab, foam your hands afterward, and there's the foam dispenser. So our foam dispensers, probably you do this too, are everywhere. I mean, they're like Starbucks. They're on every corner. They're inside every doorway. They're outside every doorway. And that's what we want. We want people to reach out and foam their hands and not have to really work for it. We want it to be right there for them when they need it. Okay, we'll go on. Just-in-time coaching. This is really tricky because if people think you're lecturing to them or at them, they're going to kind of shut you off. So we figured out some verbiage, and I've got them here for you. Another way to do that might be, or did you know, or you. Sometimes I'll say something I just learned last week that I'd like to share with you. And then caught you being awesome is a big one because I really, really try to thank people when they do a good job, and I try to thank our housekeepers. I try to thank my fellow nurses, and I try to thank administration, too, because they support us. Okay. More just-in-time coaching. This is sort of some pictures. These are our nurses. This is Did You Know? And thank you for washing your hands. We do work 5:30 to 2 so that we can catch the night shift, and we do review their charting before they go home. Again, the goal is to coach in real time. And these are some pictures of some celebrations we've done. The larger picture is for Respiratory Therapy Appreciation Week. We sent this poster all through the hospital, and everyone signed it. And then we framed it and gave it to Respiratory Therapy. And that was kind of one of the high points of our appreciation effort. Our grants do specify that we take whatever we've learned and take it out and share it with others, which is partly why I'm here today. But we have presented posters nationwide, and we've had a couple of podium presentations. So these are my fellow champions taking it to the streets. This is VAP over the last 3.5 years. We have had a jagged journey. I don't know if you guys have that too, but we've had some serious ups and downs. But the overall trend line, which you can see in dark blue, is going down. So we do focus on kind of the overall picture, and we are headed downward. I want to speed up just a little. These are our VAP rates sorted by unit and in aggregate. So if you go to the bar graph all the way to the right, these are all the ICUs. So you can see we are steadily going down. These are our device days. I especially like the third graph over, which is the MICU, because you can see every year they've had a reduction in their device days, which is their ET tubes. So they're working very, very hard to get their ET tubes out sooner. We did get Magnet this year, so I'm very proud of my group. Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'll take that back to them. Thank you. And this is our group now. And we're still learning, and we've expanded from 7 to, I think, 9 or 10. And they're watching right now, so I love you guys. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Laura Showers, and I'm here from Jefferson Healthcare in Fort Townsend. And Kathy and I were put together by APIC when we submitted our presentations, and I thought it was pretty neat that Kathy's from a very large institution. I'm from a very small institution. We are a 25-bed critical access hospital, and we're on a peninsula on a peninsula. So we're pretty isolated. It takes about 3 hours to get to Seattle from Port Townsend, so we're pretty far. But we are important. And we provide health care to our community, which is the outlying areas, about 20,000 people. And we have 9 clinics. We have our 25 inpatient beds, outpatient clinics, an ambulatory surgery center. And it's very important to our community that we do things well. So I want to... just before I start, have everyone in this room who feels passionately about patient safety to stand up, if you would, please. All right. Now give yourselves a hand for your passion. All right. And then when you sit back down, there are a few people who are just by themselves. Could you move a little bit closer, because I'm going to have you talk with each other. So it just... 2 people together, at least, would be good. Thank you. So, essentials of communication. Communication is certainly a lot about talking, but it's many other things, as I'm sure you all know. Primarily, listening. And, of course, we have to speak effectively. We have to create safety in our conversations, and when we listen, we need to be self-aware and we have to have empathy for the people that we're interacting with. As infection preventionists, it's easy for us to feel passionate about what we do, and as Kathy noticed in her work, it's easy for us to be in a silo just like everyone else is in a silo. And for me, I'm in a silo of one. I'm the only infection preventionist in the organization. Some of you may be in larger groups, but it's easy to be around each other in a silo. It's harder to go out and be with other people who you might not relate to as well. So you have to do some learning to be able to do that well. So we all have our own perspective. We come from different backgrounds, probably pretty widely different. We have different goals and aspirations. If you're the nurse manager of an ICU, you probably have some different goals and aspirations than the infection preventionist, although there are some, certainly lots of common ground. But we often are busy and don't spend enough time to get to know each other and learn each other's worlds. So and you don't have to reveal this, but if you've ever experienced someone saying, oh, no, it's the infection preventionist, and some people are raising their hands, it is really, we do add complexity to their work, and I can speak to this honestly. I was a nurse manager for 13 years before I took this position, and so I know what it's like as the receiver of the infection preventionist requests or requirements or demands to do something differently or do something more than what I already had to get done. Oh, and I wanted to, the things we're concerned about are invisible to the naked eye. Right? So microorganisms, they're not visible. And as intelligent and accomplished as the people that we're working with are, it's still just an interesting human phenomenon that if you can't see it, then maybe it's just not really there. So we have to keep that in mind. Just a few other perspectives to consider. Organizational leadership is responsible for assuring safety. And as an infection preventionist, you're part of organizational leadership. You represent your organization, and you're the person who's been deemed to try and work on these projects. And keeping in mind that almost everyone wants to do the right thing. There's a rare few who don't want to, but you can really make that assumption with people that they want to do the right thing, and I think Kathy found that as well. Everyone's job is complex and time-consuming. Everyone has more things added to their plate regularly, so we have to keep that in mind. And then we need to look for good intentions. Generally, people rise up to the expectations that you have for them. So if you have high expectations, if you feel like they're going to do the right thing, often they will do that. So to start with, I want to talk about listening. And listening isn't easy. And so you're all listening to me right now. I would guess that a good 90% of you have been thinking about other things as I've been talking. And I think that a number of you I can see are looking at little devices. And so when you're doing that, I can tell as the speaker that you aren't listening to me. So it's normal for us not to listen when other people are talking. So as you're listening to someone, if you find yourself thinking about what you're going to say in response to them, you're not listening because you're thinking. If you enter a conversation with someone with your mind already made up, so if you already know what it is that's going to come out of the conversation, then you're less likely to listen well. And if you go into the conversation feeling like you know, I'm the right one, and then you're probably not going to listen as well. And then a clue for yourself as a listener is if you leave a conversation dissatisfied, if you don't feel a sense of satisfaction at the end of it, then you can likely have not listened well. So those are just some clues for you. So listening takes time, and you have to make time for listening. Because if you do, it will save you time in the long run. When the people that you are interacting with feel listened to, they'll be more engaged, they'll be much more interested in you as the individual trying to help them or to get them to do something that you want them to do. They'll want to partner with you, and then ultimately, when you become a good listener, you'll get a reputation. And I think that We've had a lot of examples of speakers over the last few days who apparently have amazing reputations, and I have a feeling that they are probably good listeners. One of the things that we want to do as professionals is know our stuff, right? We want to be known as the person who has the answers and is good at what we do. But we also need to be have a little bit of humility and understand that the people that we're working with also have lots of information. They're professionals. They want to be respected. And a great way to respect them is to listen to them, to really hear what they have to say. Then they'll really be interested in collaborating with you, and you'll just get a reputation for that, which will be awesome for you. So in order to listen well, you have to be calm. So in that, you have to learn how to turn off the responding, the auto response as you're listening. And it's hard. You have to remember not to defend yourself. You have to try not to argue with them or complain as you're listening, because there may be a point to in time that you want to defend your position, or that you may want to have an intelligent argument or debate with that person about something or other. But the time for that is not while you're listening to their story. You have to stop and listen during that time. And then here's a difficult thing, is you can't take it personally. So everyone in this room stood up when I asked if you felt passionate about patient safety. And passion is a wonderful thing. Sometimes it can cause us to become a little over the top because we're right. And we're out here to do things that are the right things. We don't want patients to get infections. Nevertheless, it's not about us. It's not even necessarily about the patient in that conversation. What it really is about is the person who's talking. And so that's what you have to do. You have to bring your focus into the person who is trying to tell you what they want you to know about them, about their experience, about the topic at hand. So if you can plan the conversation when you're going to listen to someone, that makes it a lot easier. You can't always do that. But maybe having some self-awareness, if you're tired, if it's been a hard day, if something bad has just happened, and someone walks up to you in the hallway and wants to have a conversation about the SSI that just happened, and they want to, you know, start delving into some of the details, and you just don't have the energy for it, you might want to try and say, well, I just don't have the energy for this right now. Something just happened, or I'm so distracted. Can we make an appointment for tomorrow? If you have the energy, that might be a great time to listen, because that person's ready to tell you their story. So gauge your own energy. And then as you're listening, remember not to own the problem. If it is a problem, it's not your problem. It's a problem. So as you're listening, it's okay to ask questions. But the questions that you ask have to truly be about the topic that the person is relaying to you. So you don't want to ask a question that pulls that person into a different topic. And when you're doing that, often it's because you've been doing your self-talk and you're on to a different topic. You've moved past them. You've already answered their questions, or you've already come up with some kind of a solution and you're moving somewhere else. So that if you find yourself thinking about something other than what they're talking about, it's probably not a good time to ask a question. What you want to try and do is clarify what they're saying. So if a good question would be, so I hear you saying, and then tell them what you hear them saying, and that would be a clarifying question. Or, I don't really understand what you just said. Now, if you really did understand it and you're saying, I don't understand what you just said, because you're kind of arguing with them about it, has anyone ever done that? I know I have. You really do understand, but you're really kind of debating. So really, the clarifying questions need to be really specifically about the topic that that person is talking about. Then you want to have open body language. If you stand with your hands crossed like this, when someone's, or if you stand sideways to them, or if you, maybe somebody is, you're in the, having the hallway conversation and somebody else walks by and you look over and wave at them, you're not paying attention to that person, or you're putting up barriers to that person. So think about your body language And then try to remember to be humble and ready to hear their perspective. Empathy, I think that we've talked a lot about empathy over the years, and empathy really is a specific thing. And to have empathy, you really do have to walk in their shoes. And there's nothing like going around with someone and watching them do their job or really talking deeply with someone about their job to learn more about it. So, and the thing about empathy is that empathy doesn't cause, you're not required to lose yourself or be lost in that person's experience. So you can feel for someone or feel for a process without losing your own perspective. And that does take some practice. But keeping the end in mind can be helpful. So we all want the best for everyone. We want the best for ourselves. We want the best for our patients. And so keeping that in mind might help you with the empathy. So repeat back at short intervals. Try and check out what you heard for accuracy. And don't be afraid to interpret what you heard. And then give them the opportunity to correct you. So if you say, I just heard you say something, and they say, well, no, I actually meant this, then that's a great thing. You've really succeeded in your conversation. If you can recap to them in a way that they feel comfortable correcting what you've just said, then you can really move much more deep into the conversation with them. So we're all doing this to work together for the patient. This is our OR, and as you know, the Seattle Seahawks are a popular thing in the Seattle area, and so we were the 12th man group there. So this is just a list of what things to do to stay connected. Remember to respect them, take responsibility for your own actions, ask for what you want or need, and remember that we do need to collaborate with each other to succeed. So I want you to practice. And we don't have much time. This is very brief, but I'd like you to just spend a couple minutes thinking about something that you've had, maybe that you've talked with someone about. And if you know each other, that'd be great. If you don't, I'm just going to ask you to turn and face each other and just try and one person talk a little bit about a problem, and then the person try and listen. And really listen to what they're saying. Try not to think about anything else. Try not to think about what vendors you're going to go see or what you're going to do this afternoon. So just a couple of minutes. So turn toward the other person. Just one person, tell the other person just a brief story. Is everyone doing a good job of listening? You're really hearing what they're saying? Okay, so we're going to get another chance to talk to each other. And so in the interest of time, I'll go on and talk a little bit about speaking, because speaking effectively is a little different than listening effectively, and equally as important. We're all probably great at talking, but to do it in a way that someone's going to listen to us is a different thing. All right, thanks. So you guys got into that. Good job. All right, so speaking effectively. When you're telling your story, you have to remember that the person listening to you listens probably the same way you do. So as they're listening, they're probably thinking about something else. They're formulating their response, those kinds of things. So if you, as you're talking, you can do some things that will help to keep that person engaged in your conversation. And so you want to try and do some specific things. One of the most important things to do is to be patient with your listener. So, because they may be distracted. So try and pick a good time. Now, if you want to tell a story about infection prevention, if you want to tell them about something that's gone on, or if you want to tell them something that's difficult in particular, the best thing to do would be to make an appointment with them and meet with that person privately. It's great not to bring difficult things up in front of others, because sometimes we get embarrassed. So pick your time. And be ready with the facts about what you want to say. Remember that your story is really should be about the patient, about the specific situation. It might be nice to start with some small talk and ask them about themselves. Kathy was talking about knowing the EVS department's name, know who they are, maybe if you know a little bit about them. If you don't, ask them about themselves. So just try and make it a little more interesting and personal. When you're, it's really a great idea to stay to one topic when you're talking about especially a difficult conversation. Be clear about what you're going to talk about, and you may even want to have some notes for your own reference. And then before you go into the conversation, understand your motivation. So are you trying to get this person to change something about what they're doing? If that's what you're trying to do, then you just need to be aware of that. It may not be that you say to them, well, I'm going to try and get you to change this or that. But you want to know that in your own mind and heart, that really what you're looking for, the ultimate goal is to try and change a practice, change some kind of method. And then the other thing to be really aware of is if it's personal. So is this a personal issue for you? If you're passionate about what you are talking about, it's very possible that it's personal. So if you if infection rates are high and you're having to report those to the C-suite and you need to work with someone to get infection rates down, it's probably personal to you because it's your job to reduce infection rates in your organization. So just keeping that in mind, it's easy for things to get heated when it's personal. It's easy for people to become judgmental and have less energy or time for the conversation when you just want them to change this. I mean, can't you see that the infection rate is high? We need to change this. Well, they've got all of their own competing priorities. So what you have to do as the speaker is to make a compelling case, stay focused on what it is that you need to change, and be ready with information and data. So, It's okay to tell the story if you feel strongly about it, but you want to remember that the story is about the patient or safety. And remember that your feelings about it are just your own. The people that you're talking to don't necessarily feel the same way. It might seem obvious to you that we need to do this, but it's not to them necessarily. So don't assign blame or fault, and try and find something positive if you can. Be open. If you've listened well and spoken well, often you'll learn something in your conversation that will help you in the future. It's very common for us. We're complex emotionally as human beings, so we go into interactions with others often with a lot of baggage, and it's not unusual for us to learn something about ourselves or for something else to come up for us as we interact with another person. So when you feel passionately about something, when the other person feels passionately about something, and something else altogether can come out of it. So being open to that can be helpful, because what else comes out could be something wonderful. So I wanted you to practice being the speaker, although I think we might not have quite enough time for that. So when you work at speaking, really try and express your thought or ideas simply, without reservation. Keep it objective, and give your partner time to check in and clarify. So when you were listening, you wanted to be able to ask a clarifying question. When you're speaking, leave pauses in your conversation so that they can do that as well. So just leave little gaps so they can interject something. So I wanted to end by talking a little bit about servant leadership. So infection preventionists are leaders, and I think you all know that. And what a great way to lead is by demonstrating service or being a servant leader. So if you serve others, then you're demonstrating to them how to provide service. And participating in the project or process will take some time up front, but in the long run, it'll save you time, just like spending time listening, formulating your conversation before you go in to have a difficult conversation with someone. Spending that time up front will save you time in the long run, because you will do it better. You can make people mad at you, possibly, if you don't do it right. They might not feel heard. And those things, then you have to patch that up later, and that takes a bunch of time. So just like that, with true participation in the process up front will save you time in the long run. So helping someone kick something off, so you want them to change something, help them develop an aim or a goal. With Kathy's work, they developed the project and kicked that off. The nurse manager probably was involved, but she also worked with them and set up a plan with steps and tasks. The champions took on some of the tasks, but not all. They provided the background and the data, and then they gently encouraged the plan, do, study, act process to help drive success. So these are just some folks that I work with on some projects in our little hospital. And so the nurse champions at UC Davis, they had mutually agreed upon goals, and then they had local leaders that worked with departments to implement change. And having people on the ground at the department level made a big difference in that project. Relationship building and collaboration there got effective results. So for you, not only learning communication, but working on gaining reputation as a helper, being present in the places where you're trying to make the improvements, responding to requests promptly and eagerly, being open and available. So just to wrap it up, patient safety and quality improvement work can be very charged, as we all know. We have our own perceptions and of ourselves and of others, and without true collaboration, it's easy to get stuck. So if we are seen only as the enforcer, then we're not going to have the same results as we will if we are seen as a collaborator. So learn to tell your story, know your biases, learn to listen, learn to be persuasive without being abrasive, learn how to stay focused and don't let it get personal, and learn to be aware of how others are taking you and your message. Then I just put a few resources for you. So I think we have a couple of minutes for questions.
Good morning. I'm Teresa from Southeast Wisconsin, Chapter 30. And the first time I had the IP plums, poor little old me, I thought it was me. I took it personal. I went to my APEC chapter. I shared. And every one of them validated that in their practice they had it too. So this teleconference was lovely. But it would be nice to have some of this information maybe in the text or in the newsletter to help the novice and maybe more senior people to, again, not take it personally, and to learn that all of us get the poor little old me's in infection control sometimes. Thank you.
That's a great point. Thanks. All right, any other questions?
Lila Looper, Mercy Hospital, Ada. Kathy, I had a question about, you alluded to the five whys. What, would you elaborate what those are?
Can you hear me? Oh, lovely. I love the five whys. We learn this in our Lean Six Sigma training. When you have a problem, like if someone's not washing their hands, you can ask them why, and they will give you an answer. Let's say they said the sink was out of order. And then you'll say, why? And they'll say, well, I called the plumber, but they're not available until tomorrow. And then you ask why again. And if you ask why five times, it's been shown that you will get to the root of any problem. And so I would encourage you guys to try that, because it actually works very, very well. And that came from a child, right? The children always ask why, and it turns out that they were onto something.
So I had another question for Laura. So I really appreciated about listening and speaking, and I really enjoyed the opportunity to interact. We had spoke prior to starting, and now I'm wondering how well I did as far as speaking and listening to what we were talking about. So did you have trouble as far as getting that for yourself? What kind of barriers, or what did you have to do in order to be more aware of your listening and speaking skills?
Well, the reason that I spoke on this isn't random, and I certainly have learned a lot over the years about listening. I think that as a professional trying to implement change, I wasn't always a very good listener, and so I would try and just voiced my opinion upon people, and I was given feedback that I was constantly debating as people were trying to tell me something. So I studied and learned about listening as a personal growth process, and I've had much more success since I've done that. So this did not come naturally to me. I've gotten much better at it through practicing. All right, thank you so much for your attention.